Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. We will not have class on Monday night next week because it's the 4th of July. We could have class, but 4th of July is kind of one of those holidays where things start happening in the evening. And so I won't intrude in your lives, or I won't let you intrude in my life, whatever, however you want to look at it. I think we're going to have some of the family over. Some of the boys will come over and we'll grill or something. They won't stay long because they're going to go to fireworks. But Tony and I, we've done our fireworks in the past, and what we basically remember about fireworks is the crowd leaving at the end. And it's like, when you're younger, it's like it's worth it. But sometime around 35, 40 years old with six kids, it's kind of like, this is a waste of time. It looked just like it did the last 30 years, and we stopped going. And it's funny how the kids, you know, they kept going, or as they got families, they're going. And both Tony and I are kind of like, that's the dumbest thing to do on the 4th of July is go get into a crowd of people and sit. Anyway, it's just, not that it's right or wrong, it's just, that's one of those things where it's like, we don't do that. I do remember one 4th of July when I think our oldest was 5th grade, 6th grade, yeah, maybe 7th grade. And then Jacob was a baby. And I was pastoring a church, a country church, and they had a little, it's an old church, but it had a little fellowship hall attached to it, which is a one story, you know, with a, you know, simple roof on it. Kind of like a ranch style house. And we were in the country, and you could see three cities around us. But if you went up on the roof, you could see fireworks from three different locations. So I got a picture of it. I usually put it on Facebook every 4th of July, but I took lawn chairs up there. You put it right on the peak of the roof for Tony and myself, and had the boys all get up there and sit down, don't walk around, sit. We got out the bomb pops, you know, little red, white, and blue ice cream. And, of course, they're, you know, sixth grade and down, so this is like crazy town for them. They got bomb pops and sitting on the roof, and they still remember that. So it's kind of a interesting picture of the family sitting on a roof watching fireworks. But that was like 1995 or something like that. So we've done that too. But anyway, that has nothing to do with our subject tonight, except there's no class next Monday night. Ezra chapter 3, verse 1 through 13, they're going to lay the foundation. They're going to build the altar and begin laying the foundation for the temple. What's basically going to happen is it's going to be an exciting time. Once the people see it, or the Levites are going to get involved, and the offerings are going to get started, and the cycle is going to begin, morning and evening, the festivals are going to begin, and it's going to start right around, it's going to be the month of the seventh month, which is September, October of 537, which means that's when they resume the offerings, and they're not going to quit, they're just going to keep right on going, evening and morning. It's not a full-blown production because there's not a temple, but there is an altar, so they are starting their rituals. They must be getting their information. Obviously, it's going to refer to it. The law of Moses tells them what to do. Some of them are going to remember, and so the parents and the grandparents, you know, that were the priests can go ahead and give some explanation of what they're doing. But they haven't done it for some 70 years. You know, 56 years, if you want to, you know, count when the temple was burned or so. But they're, you know, a lot of they're going to just follow the proceedings, and they probably kept these things alive. Well, anyway, then after the seventh month, we're going to get to about April of May, which would be like the next year. So this might be 538 going to 537 or 537 going to 536. This is usually where people have it. I've got 536 on the map right here, or the chart right there, so. But this is probably right. Then in April and May, the second month, the first month is going to be the month of Passover. So we're going to assume that first month of, you know, 536 is consumed with the Passover. Everybody travels. There's three pilgrimage feasts. One of them is happening right here in the seventh month, the Feast of Booths or the Tabernacles. Another one is Passover. So in April, they're probably going to celebrate the Passover. It's not addressed here in the text. But that second month, April, May of 536 B.C., they're going to begin laying the foundation, and or it's going to be completed. They're going to have a little celebration, and then you're going to have the mixture of the two groups of people, the old and the young. The young are excited. Look what we've done. We came back to do this, and they are doing it. The old are like, you're kidding me. You think this is done? This is nothing like what we had when we were kids. Because, man, Solomon's temple would have been the massive stones, even today when you look at the Western Wall and around. You know, a lot of people just think the Western Wall is the only part of the temple, the retaining wall left. But it goes all the way around, the foundation stones. In fact, I was way down to the bottom of the southwest corner looking at the stones setting on the bedrock below the street level of, you know, 30 A.D., and so those stones are still there, and they're overlapped, so you can see them going all the way up. Even up above the ground today, you can see the southwest corner up several courses, and I could go on and on about that. But there's stones. But what I'm saying is those stones are, the ashlar stones are very accurate, very precise. They're dressed. They've got a panel going around or a boss. The margins are cut in about 2 inches. A boss sticks out about maybe half an inch, an inch, meaning it's all dressed stone. But that was all pushed over by the Romans in 70 AD. But since that time, people have put stones back up to rebuild those walls of Herod's time, of the New Testament. And even as you look at it, you can look at the lower part, you can see the dressed Herodian stones, and then as you get to the up to where the Romans stopped pushing things over, part of it, because once they got everything pushed over, they couldn't push anything else over because it's just a big pile there that you can't go anywhere with it. Some of the stones we get in the Western Wall Tunnel, the stones are so big, so massive, you couldn't move them. And so you can see in one part, and I've talked about it before, here's the original stone is like this. It's huge. I mean, it'd go across this room almost. They were going to push it, and they couldn't, so they started chipping it away. So this is all chipped away here like that. And then they just, at that point, they just like, forget it. And they just left it there. And this has been filled in then with other stones. And so what I'm going to say is you can still see some of the stones of the Herodian stones, very dressed, but they've rebuilt it, but they didn't rebuild it with nice stones. They built it with whatever was around. And they just, it's not falling over, but it's definitely, you can see where the Herodian stone course stops, and they just started patching things up and building it back up to build up the retaining wall. And so that's what these people are going to be seeing. They're going to see, or they're going to remember, and they're maybe laying around, you know, the Solomon stones, the stones from Solomon's temple. Some of them have been carried off and used in building projects other places over the last, you know, 50, 60 years before they come back. But they're just using whatever they can do to get the foundation started. And when they say the foundation, they're not just laying a slab of concrete. They're building the retaining wall so that they can have a level surface on which they can build the temple. And so they're, in a sense, putting that retaining wall back up. And when it gets done, some are going, yeah, look, we got this done. Others are going, that's not how you do it. I mean, where's the good-looking stones? You just grab stuff and stuck it up there. Well, I mean, it's not right or wrong. They're rebuilding. They don't have Solomon's, you know, skill. They don't have Solomon's time. Solomon took 7 years building the temple. But that's where this is going to be at right here. So we're talking about that tonight. Then we will continue next week we'll be here next week, chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, where all of a sudden the people around, and we'll talk about it at the end of the night, because there's two groups of people. There's the locals that have lived there since the days of Babylonian destruction. Some of them have moved in, the Gentiles have moved in. Some of them are Jews that are still continuing there. Some of them are Jews that married into the Gentiles and created the Samaritan group. But they got displaced because it was by Cyrus's order that these people were to go back to the province of Judah, given a new governor, and they're told, go to your cities. And they've got government backing, you know, that's official. This is our territory now. We got the documentation. And so the locals are being displaced. The Jews are moving in. And so they haven't abandoned the temple. I mean, it's not like just become a ghost town. Like when Islam came into Jerusalem in the 600s, the Christians on purpose had neglected the Temple Mount. The Romans destroyed it. Not on purpose, not because they're trying to fulfill Bible prophecy. They're just destroying it because the Jews had rebelled against them. It was prophecy being fulfilled, but the Romans are just doing what Romans do when someone rebels. But when the Christians came back after the second Jewish revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt, after 132-135 war, they built a bunch of churches. They Christianized the place. In fact, on the Madaba map that's found in Jordan in a mosaic, it's got Jerusalem laid out. You can identify buildings on the mosaic map. It's the map of a floor of a Byzantine church from 500 AD. All kinds of churches. There is nothing Islam in the city in 500 AD because there is no Islam. So, and the Christians have taken over. So it's not Jewish. There may be Jews around, but the Christians have Christianized it. And the Temple Mount, as Jesus says, there won't be one stone left upon another. It was just proof that Jesus was the Messiah. We're done with the Jews. The church is now ruling and reigning. And so they basically just abandoned the Temple Mount. Now, I'm pretty interested in the Temple Mount, you know, archaeology, history, Bible. But the Christians, they saw it in 500 AD, you know, from 135 up to 500 AD. They saw it as, well, that's the end of that phase. We are now in the church. We're now in the New Testament. And so they even used it as a garbage dump. So when Islam came in, they cleaned it up and began to restore it and built right on top of where the temple had been. We'll talk about that. But that's kind of what was taking place here, was they're coming back, and the Christians didn't go up and honor the Temple Mount. They had churches, basilicas. But in this time, during while the Jews were gone, they did not abandon the Temple Mount. That had always been, going back to Melchizedek, Genesis with Abraham, they'd always gone up to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah was a shrine, a holy place. Something was there, some kind of altar, some kind of meeting with God. Even when the Jebusites and Canaanites, and they would indeed meet with Yahweh there. You go back, the Canaanites weren't like, you know, ungodly, you know, their whole history. It's like America in 1700s and 1800s, 1900s, and then America today in another 20, 40 years. It's like, you know, it's not your morality, your religion, it fluctuates, and they decline. My point for saying all that is when the Jews were taken into captivity, someone just filtered in and began to continue to worship on that Temple Mount. It wasn't just necessarily, it was rubble, but something was there. And so when they're going to do this, the people that are coming back with orders from Cyrus, again, this is not just toughen up and go get it done. They've got paperwork. You know, this is the emperor who's conquered everybody, says, we're supposed to be here. So they've got authority, but at the same time, they're there alone. They don't have Cyrus's military. They've just got Cyrus's decree. And so you can see there's going to be some opposition. And that's going to start showing up here in these verses right here. And they're going to take, the locals are going to take their paperwork, and they're going to file charges, and it's going to scare the Jews. It's going to slow things down. Cyrus has got everybody's return. It's not the only thing Cyrus is doing. And Cyrus is going to, you know, he's not going to live forever. By 530, Cambyses is the emperor. And Cambyses is going, his main goal is to go to Egypt and conquer Egypt. This is not a priority. I mean, Cyrus signed the decree, sent him out. But now you've got it tied up in legal battles. And you're not going to get back. If you look at this chart right here, this is October 12th, October 29th, 537. You've got Cyrus coming in October. You've got the Jews returning in September, October of 537 by the time they get back. You've got Ezra chapter 3, which is 537, 536 by the time we get to the end of the chapter right here. And the next thing you've got in Ezra, watch the chart, is Ezra chapter 4 in 485, talking about what was taking place in 485. And then you've got Ezra 6 and Ezra 5 right here. So Ezra 3 and then Ezra 4, verses 1 through 5, the opposition, and that's it. There's silence, nothing, until you get to 520. And before you get to Ezra chapter 5, you've got to go through Haggai and Zechariah, and then Ezra 5 picks up again and says, and now they're building the temple. So what we're going to have to do, what I'm going to do, is we'll look at chapter 3 tonight, look at chapter 4, 1 and 5, next, 1 through 5 next time, and then realize this temple building is locked up in lawsuits, and it's not a priority to the Persians. And the Jews are kind of like, well, there's nothing we can do. We got a lawsuit. And you maybe worry about it for a month, you worry about it for a year, but after a year, 2 years, it's kind of like, well, life is going on. You've moved on, you started a business, it's like you're doing the best you can. And then 10 years goes by, 20 years goes by. I mean, you might have been 20 years old and you were back here helping rebuild the temple, and now 20 years goes by, now you're 40, and it's like, well, you know, we just never got it done. And that's when the prophets are going to show up and go, God is, he's not happy. And there's several things going to happen here. In Ezra chapter 5 and 6, they're going to take it up legally, and they're going to win the lawsuit, but the prophets are going to stir the people up and say, hey, you got to get this going, because, especially in the book of Zechariah, this is going somewhere. This is not just you rebuilding a temple, making God happy. God needs the temple. He needs this nation rebuilt, because the next phase of his plan has to take place, which is going to be the coming of the Messiah and the continuation. So that's what's going to take place. So anyway, chapter 3 tonight, we'll read through it. I'll read first the NIV, what we've got in chapter 3, verses 1 through 13, and then I'll go back, I'll read through the notes, make a few comments. Maybe I'll make comments as I'm going. Who knows what's going to happen. But here we are. After chapter 2, chapter 2 is basically the return. The people are back. We got all the priests are all back. You've got Levites that are back. You got the temple servants that are back. The different families are back, and they've gone to their own towns. Now, for however long they've been back, if it's, you know, October 29th in 538, 539, now it's maybe a year later, now they're back, but they've been back for a period of some months. That time that they've been back, they've gone to their cities, the homes where they're supposed to go. They've got property. They've settled in, and everybody now is established in their homes. But now on the seventh month, September, October of 537, again, that's probably the date. We're not for sure. We just know it's the seventh month. We know the month, this year, is at 536, 537. That's fluctuating. This is probably right. Now it's time for them to gather as a people, and they got to now begin the worship that they came back to do. Because remember, they're not just pleasing God. They're not just pleasing God in this endeavor. They're doing what Cyrus wants done. Remember what Cyrus wants done on that Cyrus cylinder? He wants whatever your God is. I'm tolerant. I'm a polytheist. I mean, there's many gods. I've got my God, but I want all of you to go worship your gods and then pray to your gods that your God favors me and talks to my God about helping me. So let's get everybody on the same page. You go to your gods. And so they're under orders from Cyrus to go back and please their God, so their God will talk to Cyrus's God and keep him strong, if that makes sense. So there's not just they're being obedient to Yahweh, but they've also got paperwork, not just Cyrus saying, hey, I want to be friendly. If you're interested in going back, go ahead. If you're not, it's like, we'll let it go. It's like, no, I need someone going back, because there's a God there that's been conquered by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and both those empires are gone. I'm in charge now, and I'm not going to make the same mistake the Assyrians and the Babylonians made of just annihilating these gods, saying, we've got all your stuff over here. We're going to go back and restore those gods, because that will give us even more favor, more power, and my kingdom will last forever and ever. So they're not just going back to please God. They are. But they also are having to please Cyrus. So in other words, they really don't have an option, because they could get in trouble with Cyrus. He sends them back. He finances it. And then America is such a poor example of this. We're going to give you a government grant with the expectation that you're going to do such and so. Okay, well, here's the transfer of the money. And then they go back to Congress, and we need more money, and they get some more money, and it's like, is anybody following up, especially after all those, that COVID money, all that money was sent out? It's like, and did we ever follow up on that? Oh no, it was so much money, we can't keep track of where it all went. Whoa, that's what they've done. Cyrus has sent them back and has financed it, but they could be called and held account for, why didn't you, where's this temple I sent you to build? Well, we just didn't get around to it. In America, well, here's some more money. Maybe you'll do it this time. In Cyrus, it may be, may cut everybody's head off. I don't know. Wouldn't that be something if they started cutting people's heads off for misappropriation, spending of funds? It's like, well, not that we want to have that, but anyway, that's a little over the line here for tonight. So here we go. Chapter 3, verse 1. When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. I mean, they're on to the next phase, the worship. Then Jeshua, son of Jozadad, that's the priest, going to be known as Joshua in Haggai and Zechariah. And his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, that would be from the line of David. So right there you've got the priestly tribes, and you've got the royal tribes. And again, that's going to be a big issue here in Zechariah, because that's going to come together as the two are representing the Messiah, who's going to be both in one. And his associates, that'd be the governor. So you've got the high priest, and you've got the governor, who's appointed governor by Cyrus, and it's also from the line of David. And his associates, they began to build, notice what they're building, the altar of God of Israel, to sacrifice burnt offerings on it in accordance with what was written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they have the law. They're going to follow the law. They're going to build it according to the law. And they're going to build it not just somewhere. The next verse is going to say it. They're going to put it in the right place. They're following the law. There's a location for this. Despite their fear of the peoples around them, they built the altar on its foundation and sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both morning and evening sacrifices. So there is fear. There's two things taking place here. There's faith in God. And at this point right now, they're actually acting in faith. They've got the paperwork, Cyrus's decree, but they're there in the province of Judah, not surrounded by Cyrus's military protection and his government officials, but surrounded by the locals who are like, yeah, we don't like this. You're taking our property, you're taking our land, and now they're building the altar on the foundation. Now, when we say foundation, it's not just the foundation of the temple. That's another thing that's going to come. The foundation is the foundation where the altar goes. It would be the bedrock of Mount Moriah, where the altar sat that Solomon built, which was probably the location where other altars in the past had been placed. We could even suggest that would be the location that Abraham offered Isaac. I mean, we know it's Mount Moriah, but when you start talking about, was it on this rock or that rock or what part of the Mount Moriah, we don't have exact details, but you could at least suggest that this is not just, they've got a group of Samaritans worshiping here, and here's, it looks like someone started a little altar over here. Well, here, this place is open. Let's build it here. No, they're building it in its place, which, I'm sorry, Solomon's altar sat right here. I'm not sure what this is, and I'm not sure what you're offering on it, but we're going to have to move this. And whatever was there, They bulldozed it, whatever they did for bulldozes, and they rebuilt it. So right away, you've already made somebody mad because, wait, this is where we worship. We've been using this for 30 years. I grew up worshiping on this. It's like, what? And so they're acting in faith, but they don't have a military to help them. And there are people that are against what they're doing. I don't think we can emphasize enough that they, in fact, this verse makes it very clear. They're doing all of this in fear. Not fear of God. They've got faith in God. They're doing this, they're honoring God. So yes, they have a fear of God. But what they're afraid of is like, oh my gosh, this is going to make somebody mad. There's going to be repercussions. And so it's like, I hope God's got our back. I hope Cyrus doesn't forget about his paperwork because we're doing this. And that's what that verse is saying. There is, and again, that's going to build up until we get to chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, until the people that they're afraid of are going to take it to the courts. And then they're going to get it built, and it's not going to be a happy time. For them, it's going to be a happy time in 520, but it's going to lead to problems. And then you're going to eventually have, remember, go all the way up here to Nehemiah. Comes to build a wall in 445. And remember what happens. First of all, they're opposed for building the altar and the foundation. They don't do anything for 20 years. Then they finally, in 516, they get the temple built, but they don't have any protection around the city. So the people, the locals, just kind of, it's like, we don't want you even to be here. But they take the houses. All right, well, you got the houses, just don't mess with the altar. Ah, they bulldozed our altar, now you got the altar. It's like, we're not liking this. And then they start making a platform, the foundation, laying a platform, retaining walls, and the locals are like, okay, this is enough. And they go to file paperwork, the lawsuits that we'll talk about next week. And that holds it up until 520. In 520, the prophet's got the people fired up. They're telling them, God is going to judge you if you don't get this thing done. God is opposed, and you're making all kinds of lazy excuses. They go and win the lawsuit, and the people build the temple. And the people are like, well, that's all right. I mean, but just, you know, we'll still use our what we've got here and have access to the city. You're not that big of a threat. So they got the altar. Then they got the foundation. Now they finally got the temple. But they go until 445, and no one will let them build a wall. You're not going to build a wall. You know, we want to keep an eye on you. We're not going to, there's no Second Amendment here. You don't get your own gun. We'll keep, and all of a sudden Nehemiah, it's like, wait, we need to get everybody some weapons, and we need to get a wall built. It's like, what, you're going to arm everybody and put a wall up? Okay, you're like acting like you're your own little nation here. It's like, this is, so that's when the wall gets built. So you can see it's just, first they take some houses and property, then they take the altar, then they take the foundation, then they actually build the temple, and then finally they build a wall around it. And you see, it's not just they come back to Jerusalem and we show up where here it is. They got to chip away. It's a battle with the local people the whole way from 537 all the way up until 458. And the Samaritans and the locals are opposing them. So right here, when it says in this verse 2, then Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of God of Israel to sacrifice burnt offerings on it in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses. They're following the law and burnt offerings. And then it's going to say evening and morning. But that's the next verse. Despite their fear of the peoples around them, they are afraid. They are not just, you know, going into an abandoned land. They're going into a fully occupied, functioning land on a temple mount that probably is having sacrifices offered on it, and no longer is anybody there. You've got to go find someplace else to worship because this is our altar. And so there's a reason to be afraid of these people. They built the altar on its foundation and sacrificed burnt offerings. Again, on the foundation would be where the altar is supposed to be. And sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both morning and evening sacrifices, indicating right there that they're up and running. They didn't just come back here and do it. Well, that was fun. We should do this again next month. No, you did it today. Tomorrow morning, we're going to be right back here doing the same thing. The priests are up and running. And then they're going to have evening sacrifices. And this thing is going to go on day after day after day. And it's going to go on for 20 years. They just don't have a temple. sacrifice. Okay. Verse 4. Then, in accordance with what was written, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles. So when they come up here, now we find out that this is the seventh month. We'd already said that. But it's the 15th of the seventh month, probably 537. And on the 15th of the seventh month, that is when they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. That's when they celebrate the Feast of Booths, and that's what is mentioned here. Then, in accordance with what was written, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles. So that was the purpose for everyone assembling as one man and being a unified group. They're coming to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Booths, that is where they come to remember living in the wilderness and having to live in little tents, little shelters. But it also is them living in where God dwells with them. So the booth represents them living in booths with God in the wilderness, but also God dwelling with them. In fact, this is going to be a big feast. When we talk about in Zechariah, this is going to be a big feast in Zechariah eschatologically, that all the nations in the kingdom of God on earth are going to need to come worship at the Feast of Tabernacles, because that is where you're honoring the fact that God now dwells with man. So this Feast of Booths is them remembering dwelling in tents with God. The days now, it's also prophecy of God coming and dwelling with man. So that's what this first feast was about. And so not only are they beginning the evening and morning sacrifices, they're also now resuming for the first time the feast. They're not just going to do this one feast. Well, we did a feast. We'll pick up some other ones later. No, once they did this feast on the 15th, what's the next feast? And that means when they come back here in the second month, which will be April and May of the year, let's say 536, the first month before that is the Passover. So they will have celebrated the Passover, and they'll come back to celebrate in April and May. Okay. Then, verse 4, then in accordance with what was written, they celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles with the required number of burnt offerings prescribed for each day. It's a week-long feast. After that, they presented their regular burnt offerings, the new moon sacrifice, and the sacrifice for all the appointed sacred feasts of the Lord, as well as those brought as freewill offerings to the Lord. In other words, they've resumed a full schedule, daily sacrifices, the burnt offerings. They've resumed the full schedule of the feast, but they also have, if you're going to have a freewill offering, it's up and running. You can bring your own freewill offering, your own choice. You can do that. On the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not yet been laid. Okay, so that says on the first day of the month. So the feast would be on the 15th. That first day of the month is when they began the offering. So that says what's taking place right there. Now, that begins, now verse 7, That was, again, there's many things taking place. You notice how little information we've got. We got six verses. I've talked quite a while, and all we said was in the seventh month, they came, built the altar, resumed the sacrifices. And Joshua and Zerubbabel were there, and they were afraid of the people. So there's a lot going on there. Now, we're going to jump ahead to the second month. So we've had the seventh month, so 7 to 12, that's 5 months. And then you're going to have the first and second month over here. That's 2 more months. This is now 7 months later. This is in April, May. Excuse me. I did that wrong, right? It's their second month. It would be... Okay, I just got confused. Because we're talking about their seventh month and their second month. So that's 5 months plus 2. That would be 7. Yes, in October to April. Okay, I got the two calendars confused. My mind just... It's hard to spell and do math while you're talking. And then it's hard to do math, even adding 5 and 2, if you're using Hebrew months and English months, or whatever we call them. And then it's like, well, wait, is it second, fourth month, fifth? Well, okay, but you understand. If you didn't understand, watch the video. You can see it happen again. But now we're in the next year. It's our fourth month, but it'd be their second month. It's Passover is in April, the first month, and they're now in the second month, April, May, 7 months later. After they've got the altar up and running and the system's working, then they gave money to the masons and carpenters and gave food and drink and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre. So it's taking place here. We've got two groups of people now. They're getting ready to build the temple. They're going to first lay the foundation. And when I say foundation, they're not pouring a garage, laying a foundation like this. They're coming up to Mount Moriah, and just like the Romans pushed the walls over around the temple, you got the temple building itself, but it's standing on Mount Moriah, which is a mountain. Now, again, we're not talking about a snow-capped mountain. We're talking about a rising rock formation. It's not quite this dramatic. But you can't build a temple here, especially if you build it. There's a rock popping up over here. You put the altar here. What you're going to need is you're going to need a flat surface. And so what to get a flat surface, you're going to have to build a retaining wall. You're going to have to build blocks up here. And it's going to have to be interlocking. And then you're going to have to fill this in with fill, dirt, like this. And then once that's done, then you're going to have to pave this, and you're going to be able to pour concrete, because they don't have concrete. You're going to have to lay down rocks, flat rocks, to have this all surface like that. And so this is why the temple would look like this. This is the retaining wall holding up this right here. You might have a rock of Mount Moriah popping up here. In fact, you can walk on the Temple Mount today, and you can see rock formation right there, and then you got paving stones. Then you may have a rock formation right here, and then paving stones. Does that make sense to you? So when they're laying the foundation, they're not just laying this. They're getting this wall put back up, making sure this is all even and filling it in, and then they're laying this down right here. Now, the problem is they're going to get this far. Now, again, I'm not sure if they got walls up or not. They're going to have the altar from the first part of the chapter, and then now they're going to start collecting money for the workers. And you can see what it described. The workers are going to need. They gave money. This is the people giving free will offerings for masons and carpenters. Masons, stone masons, carpenters, wood workers. They're going to, and again, they're not putting anything wooden up, but they're going to need wood framing and structuring, scaffolding to get all this moved. And then notice right here, they're going to need timber. Now, they've got permission from Cyrus to use the forest of Lebanon. Tyre and Sidon are the cities there, and there's a lot of trees. David and Solomon both used the cedars. In fact, just like we talked about, the nails that they just took out of Hezekiah's tunnel, they had cedar wood fragments on it, sluice gate. That's what you sluice gate? That's how you say that. That would have been probably made out of cedar. And the frame that would have slid and would have been made out of cedar. And in fact, there's cedar remains on the nails they just took out. But they're going to need the cedars. And up in Lebanon, they've got the forest. But what they're short on is grain and olive oil. Watch this right here. Why didn't they collect money for the people of Sidon? It says, they gave food and drink to the masons, carpenters, and it says, and they gave money to the masons and carpenters and gave food and drink and oil. Food would be grain, drink would be wine, and oil would be olive oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre, that's the people of Lebanon, where the forest is at, so that they would bring cedar logs by sea from Lebanon to Joppa, as authorized by Cyrus, king of Persia. So what they would do is coming down this coast. Here's Tyre, Sidon's up here. They'd float the logs down to Joppa, which is, you know, right below the word Samaria there, and then they'd drag them up to Jerusalem. That's exactly what Solomon did and what David did when he built his house of cedar from Lebanon. They used, actually, even then, the stonemasons came from Tyre and Sidon. But the timber, they're going to pay for that with food. I'll say grain, wine, and oil, because these people have plenty of timber up in Lebanon, but they could use the grain. So they're exchanging food for lumber. And it's authorized by Cyrus. Verse 8, in the second month of the second year. So that means they've been there in, back in the land for 2 years. Or this is the beginning of the second year. And the second month is also the year Solomon began building his temple. And again, don't forget, one of the reasons is the first month is Passover month and everybody's busy. It's like the holidays, Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving. Let's do it in the middle of January. So that's what they do. In the second month of the second year, after their arrival at the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel son of Shealtiel, Jeshua son of Jozadak, and the rest of the brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who had returned from the captivity to Jerusalem, began to work, appointing Levites 20 years of age and older to supervise the building of the house of the Lord. Notice right here, the people are giving money for the workers, the carpenters and stonemasons, and they're giving grain and wine to help purchase the timber from Lebanon. That's what the people are doing, what we would say the laity. But the people that are going to be doing the work, it's going to be overseen by the governor, which is Zerubbabel, and it's going to be done by the priests and the Levites. So when you think of priests and Levites, especially Levites, do not think of your local pastor who, you know, has never really had a real job. I mean, maybe waited tables in seminary or something like that, but basically his job is counseling and advice and organization and leadership, and he's like the CEO and has the vision. These guys are stonemasons. The Levites are the guards of they're the doorkeepers. They're not your local usher. They're the guards. They not only can use a knife to slice up a sacrifice, they can turn that skill set into a sword and slice you up if you violate the holy place. So when you're talking about Levites and priests, you're talking about not just somebody that went to seminary and now is a leader of a church. You're talking about someone who is trained to cut up animals. We're more like a meat plant worker that's holy unto the Lord. That's the priest. They slaughter animals. I mean, they don't kill every Passover a lamb. They kill a lamb, sacrifice, and cut it up for every family. But they also cut up goats and bulls. If you can imagine bringing a bull and tying it down and cutting it up. I mean, we're talking cowboys and guards and what do you call bouncers? I mean, this is a tough crowd. When you read these guys, when the Levites have any kind of a conflict in the Bible, they come out on top because they've got the swords and they've got the skill set. So again, when we talk about these guys, oh, the priests and Levites, I bet their hands are really tender. It's like, no. These guys are. I mean, whenever a temple was built, the stones were they were trained to do these things. So just keep that in mind when we talk about priests and Levites. Don't just default to your local pastor. Oh, these guys are like the local pastor. Not at all. Then in the second month of the second year, after the arrival of the house of God in Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor from the line of David, Jeshua, son of Jozadak, and the rest of the brothers, and that is the priests and Levites and all who had returned from the captivity of Jerusalem, began the work appointing Levites 20 years of age and older to supervise the building of the house of the Lord. Jeshua and his sons and brothers and Kadmiel and his sons, descendants of Hodaviah, these are all priests, and sons of Hedadad and their sons and the brothers, all Levites, joined together in supervising those working on the house of God. Now, some of those that were doing the woodworking and the carving would be some of them coming from Sidon, and they'd be doing work, but they'd be overseen by these Levites. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple, again, laid the foundation, not just this part, but built the wall, filled this in here, and then laid the pavement right there. Again, it's going to take a lot of work. The priest, temple of the Lord, the priest in their vestments, when with trumpets. Now, not only are they bouncers and stonemasons, and they're musicians. And this is what there's a whole group set aside for this. And the Levites, the sons of Asaph, which is amazing, they were around in David's time, Asaph, And now he's still got descendants. They've still traced their genealogy from Asaph. And he was one of the Beatles originally, I think. He wrote songs with John and Paul, I guess. But anyway, he wrote some of the Psalms. I'm just trying to be funny right there. But he wrote a lot of the Psalms. His descendants, who are still practicing their instruments, they took with cymbals, took their places to praise the Lord. Now, it mentions cymbals because that would be the percussion. That would be the beat. That's setting, the beat. And they've got other instruments that are joining in. The instruments are joining in, and they're singing as prescribed by David, king of Israel. And this is all, they're still going back to not just Moses, but what David laid out for the priests. These are the songs. These are how many instruments you're going to have. These are the divisions of the priests. You guys are going to be the percussion. You guys are going to be the stringed instruments. You guys are going to be the vocals. And they just kept this thing going. They've come back from captivity. They're in place. With praise and thanksgiving, they sang to the Lord, He is good, and His love to Israel endures forever. Now again, His character, He is good. God is good. And this covenant, His love to Israel endures forever. And again, drop the word love from the English understanding. He's love, puts up with everything. He's love. He's faithful to the covenant. And that means His love to Israel, His covenant love, His swearing of a vow to see Israel through to the end endures forever. The fact that they're back building this temple, laying this foundation, is the sign of God's love. Again, not love because He is nice, but love as in a vow. Love as in a covenant commitment. He has entered into a covenant of love that I will not leave you. I may have to discipline you. I may have to do some things to adjust your understanding, but I will do what I've said. And that's what they're saying. He is good, and we're back here because this covenant that He has made with Israel is never going to pass away. And now, listen, that's exciting even today. God is good. But this covenant with Israel, He is going to fulfill it. So when we start reading the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, they're going to encourage the people in 520, but they're also going to have the people looking ahead. This is what this covenant means. This is where He's going with this. Now, we can look at some of these things as historical, but when we look at Haggai and Zechariah, we're also going to have to look into the future. It's like, He's not done. It's like, well, I'm not sure of what God's doing. Well, I don't know, like, because I talk to God what God is doing, but I can tell you what God is doing. He's right now, today, fulfilling His covenant of love with Israel. Just like in 520, He is still getting that thing to the place that He promised He's going to take it. He hasn't changed. And so that's what they're singing. What they're singing about, God's character is good, and He is going to do what He said He's going to do with Israel. And that's got to be encouraging because they're surrounded by people who are saying, boo, boo, we don't want you here, and worse. And all the people gave a great shout of praise to the Lord, and the word Lord is Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. They've got this altar here. They've been using this altar. It's in the right place. Now the retaining walls are built. The fill is in. The temple stones, the pavement is laid out. It's like, wow, we're good to go. And it's like the sacrifices have been going for 7 months. They're keeping all the feasts. You've got the priests in their clothing, the vestments, and they got the cymbals, they've got the music instruments, they're singing the songs, and the people are responding to the songs. And they gave a great shout because of what they see. But watch this. That's because of the momentum of 536 B.C. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple. So some of these priests, if you do the math, if they had been, say, 30 years old in 586, they're now still alive. They had just entered the priesthood, something like Ezekiel just turned 30 5 years after 597, so 592, I think, is right around when Ezekiel turned 30. That means he was a priest. He would have entered into the priesthood, but he couldn't because he was in Babylon. But in 586, if they turned 30 or they were like 30, 35, they're still functions. They're still, they came back. They remember being trained in Solomon's temple. And then they saw it burn and have been in captivity talking about it. And now they're back and everybody's excited. And they came back because we're following eschatology. I mean, again, eschatology or prophecy, because we're fulfilling what Jeremiah and Isaiah said. This is the word of God happening in our lifetime. And they're excited about it. But when they see it, it's like, this is even close. This is even close to what we thought God was going to do. I remember Solomon's temple. These stones are way too small. Maybe they've got some big Solomonic stones that they've built on. In fact, you can still see some on the Temple Mount today. The top of the, as you walk across the pavement, to go, there's a platform built by the Muslims to put the Dome of the Rock on. It's got maybe 12 steps. You'd have to count them. I got pictures of it. And most of the stairways are square with the platform. But there's one set of stairs that is twisted. So you go up, the stones start at an angle. They're not lined up square with the platform. And that's because the first row of stones that are the steps were already there. And then they just built on those. And what they've discovered, especially Lene Rittmeyer, he's the one that discovered this. I mean, the people have been walking on it for centuries. It's like, wait a minute. This is a line of, they're finished dressed stones. And you can see on the front edge, you can see the margin that was cut on, because you only see about this much of them. But you can see the margin. Then you can see the boss. That's the part that kind of sticks out the face. You can see it. And then he looks and goes, oh my gosh, this is Solomon's Western Retaining Wall. That's this wall right here. We're standing on this rock, right? This is all pushed over. We're standing on this rock right here, that right now today. And once he came out with the research, they put pavement, they put stones down, covered up that margin, and then poured concrete so you couldn't see the front of the stone. So he's got pictures before. Look what I found. And then he comes back, he's like, look, what? They read his paper, and the Muslims covered it up. So you can still see the stone is probably, that row of stones, probably this big. And you can see how it goes straight down like that, you know, and then the platform is at a different angle. I got pictures in the book, and it'll be in color coming out in this fall. But anyway, you can still see some of the stone. You can still see some of the stones of Solomon's Western Retaining Wall that these people would have been standing on, using, or working with. They would have been there. And what Herod did, if you don't mind, here's what Herod did. If this was Solomon's retaining wall that he filled in right here for his wall, what Herod does is expand it. He comes out here and builds a retaining wall out here, lays this on the bedrock down here, and I've stood right down here and saw these stones. It's not like I'm special. It's just I went some places and took some chances, and all of a sudden I found myself right there. And it was like, oh, it was pretty cool. We were like, where are we? It's like, oh, that's a Herodian stone. There's the bedrock. I know where we're at, because we're in tunnels under Jerusalem, and we're staying right here. We came up right underneath Robinson's Arch. Anyway, that's another story I tell you. But anyway, Herod built this and then just filled this all in. And that's why those stones on the pavement today, you can still see that stone right there. So he expanded it out this way and to the south and to the north. And that's what these people have done right there. And they're excited, but like I said, what you see as they built on this and built these retaining walls up, it wasn't the same fancy dressed stones. They didn't have that kind of time. So everybody's excited. It's 536. It's a big momentum. But some of the older priests and the Levites and even the people that remember the Solomon's temple, it's like, this isn't it. I was hoping for so much more. And here it says right here, verse 12, but many of the older priests and Levites and family heads, that'd be the laity, who had seen the former temple, Solomon's, wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid, because it's like, this is not good. There's no, it needs to be bigger than this. This is No, this is not even close. It's like, you know, a child imitating what their father built. It's like, no, this is not it. So they're like disappointed. So they're crying or weeping, while many others shouted for joy. Yay, look what we've done. You only think it's good because you didn't see what we had before. No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sounds of weeping. So again, they're not just like, I guess what captures me in that verse is their emotions. I mean, if someone's disappointed, I mean, if I'm disappointed, I may, you know, gripe and complain, and you may hear me, you know, talking about it, but I'm not going to start wailing and weeping. You know, it's like, you'll definitely hear me complaining, Facebooking comments or something like that. But it's interesting because I think that could be part of the difference in the culture, you know, of just their response of just how they express their emotion. Again, that's part of a cultural thing. I would think that's part of it. But some are very excited, some are very weeping. And it says, no one could distinguish the sound of shouts of joy from the sounds of weeping. I suppose those that are there in the mix, but also guess who? Guess who's watching? The locals are watching. It's like, what is going on up there? They're celebrating. I don't think, that sounds like they're crying. It's like, I don't know, it sounds like a bunch, but they came out and goes, what is going on? First they build an altar, what do they got done now? And this sets the stage for what we're going to read next time, chapter 4. When they come up, they see this, like, what is going on? Everybody up there, they're shouting, they're shooting off fireworks. What's going on? It's like, no, they're not going to get away with this. It says, no one could distinguish the sound of shouts of joy from the sound of weeping because the people had made so much noise and the sound was heard far away. Because they're on Mount Moriah, it's going to go down the Kidron Valley, both directions. It's going to go down the Hinnom Valley. It's going to go all around the neighboring, you know, the villages. That sets up chapter 4, verse 1. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and says, let us help you build because like you, we seek your God. That's our temple mount. We've been using that for the last 50 years. It's the same God. We want to help you. We'll help. We'll give you some ideas that we've got. Again, now right here it sounds like Zerubbabel's being a real jerk. It's like, hey, can we help you? It's like when they say help you, they mean we want to participate because we've got some great ideas also. And we've been worshiping him, sacrificing him since the time of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. What? Esarhaddon brought you here. Well, you're not Jews. They're Gentiles. They came from some other culture, some other country, and they were deported here because they were judged, just like the northern Israel was judged, but they were deported into Israel. And so they've come, and this is exactly what we've been trying to do. We've got some gods. We've got some ideas. We've got some sacrifices. Let's participate. Let's work this together. But Zerubbabel, Joshua, the governor, the priest, and the rest of the heads of families of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building a temple to our God. This is Israel. They just got done singing, his love to Israel endures forever. This does not include bringing all the nations in and you all helping contribute to our worshiping of Yahweh and what you think you want to do. We're following a specific code. You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. And again, they're pulling two cards out right there. We are going to do it the way God told us to do it, and we've got permission from Cyrus that we should do it for our God. We're going to do it for our God. Cyrus wants it built for our God. You have no part of this. And Zerubbabel and Joshua, they are correct. They're doing the right thing. It's like, well, see right there? That's not a very Christian attitude. They should be more inclusive. They should let them come in and so they feel comfortable. This should be more of a seeker temple, you know, and let everyone have a part in it and feel like they belong and they can all find worth and have to be justified in who they are. It's like, no, we've already got directions from God what we're supposed to do. We're doing this. You can conform to God's image and do it this way, but we are not going to go over there and have church. You know, there's a difference there. If you're doing outreach and everything is this, but you see it right there. It's like, well, they could have got so much more done. They could have reached a whole lot more people, right, and made a whole bunch of people happy, and God would have been like, not even close. And it comes right down to that so many times. Are you making God happy, or are you making people happy? Are we just solving people's issues, or are you going about God's business? Well, some people would make it, it's a default setting. If I'm solving people's problems, I'm doing the work of the Lord. Well, no. Then Jesus didn't even do that. Jesus did his Father's will. And many times he walked right away from problems. He didn't, he healed people. Yeah, he healed and did out of his compassion and for a sign to get people's attention to demonstrate who he was. But he didn't come in. He could, as you know, he could have solved world problems while he was here. He could have solved hunger. And I think that's where Judas got a little bit mixed up. It's like, We could be, the disciples even said it, and I got to quit, but you know, when they poured the oil on him, and they said, this could have been sold, even Judas, it's like, this could have been sold for a lot of money and given to the poor. I mean, we could have solved, if you're about doing God's work, we could have solved a lot of people's problems by selling this oil, but instead, she just dumped it on you. She did it for my burial. It's like, well, that didn't help anybody's problems. It's like, well, we're not here to solve people's problems. We're here to do the work of God. Sometimes they overlap. Sometimes they're going the opposite directions. And right here's one of those classic examples. Would have been a great time to build community and get everybody together and unified on a project. Yeah, but you would have been not doing what God called you to do. There's no part. You have no part of this. Again, that's just kind of, you know, an interesting way of seeing that and looking at it. But that's, you got to say either Zerubbabel and Joshua are jerks, or they're men of God doing what God wanted them to do. Because, I mean, they're coming in, they're flying in the face of a church building program right there. They're flying in the face of how to reach your community for Christ. You have no part of us. What? Where's the love of God? It's like, well, the love of God's right here. But anyway, interesting. I'll pick this up next week, and then we're going to have to take a break from Ezra, I think. We could jump up here, but I'd always be referring back to remember, and we can't remember because we didn't talk about it. And, of course, that's a 2-year break probably, you know, by the time we get through Zechariah and Zerubbabel or Haggai. Thank you for being here. You don't have to agree with everything I say. There's a balance as an example. I mean, I know there's surely a pastor somewhere who, you know, is, you know, a mechanic or, you know, can build a house or do woodworking, but I know some of them that have gone from high school to college to seminary to your local church to tell you how to live your life. It's like, have you ever done anything besides go to school and come here and get hired by a board? Well, no, I'm just friendly. Okay, so, and that's not everybody, but there's a lot of them out there that it's like, don't be giving me life advice. They want to be a life coach. It's like, go get a job. Okay, I'll pray, and you're free to disagree with me. Father, we thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we may again live a life that is pleasing to you and that we would follow your word. We do thank you for the opportunity to be here at this time in history that we can contribute to your plan, and ask that we again would be sensitive to your leading, be sensitive to your word, what you'd have us do in our lives, each individually and as a group. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Thank you for your time.